Medicare, state employees only. There's a subsidy based on years of service that makes our pre-Medicare insurance the equivalent cost of the PEB insurance. So it's out of their pocket, but we just try to make it the same cost. The subsidy just fills that gap. So if ours is $1,100 a month and PEB is $800 and you've got 30 years in the system, you'll get, you know, the difference is the subsidy amount. There's only about 875 state employees that participate in that program. Both of our insurance programs are funded on an actuarial basis. The cost to employers is about 40 basis points, about four-tenths of 1% of the payroll.
Okay. And my second question, please.
Follow up.
You say that the average annual benefit is $22,500 over the last 10 years, but could you give us an example, say, over the last 3 years, what that would be?
Mr. Chair, let me grab my PERS by the numbers. I think I might have last year's in that exactly. For those who retired in the most recent year, the average benefit is $27,500.
Okay.
For those who retired in 2005, for the
Thank you.
I'll flip to page two then, and this again you saw before just gives you an idea of the. The membership that we cover, we're about a little bit more than 40% in school districts and 30% each in local government and state agencies. You can kind of see where Tier 2 membership now is about the equivalent in the active terms of the Tier 1 membership. Tier 1's the last person's club. Both of those tiers are last people clubs. No new employees go into those. They go into the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. This next page, we've got a replacement map, and I think it's in your on your table there. We made an attempt here to move from being a tabular-based agency to a GIS-based agency, and we transcribed the Hood River County data twice, both in Hood River and in Harney County in your map, but this corrected one shows the distributions. And I just point out that while this is Oregon, we send benefit payments to all 50 states, as well as Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. The Oregon total here, this is for 2006, was $2.3 billion, went to 100,000 recipients. Other states, about $314 million to 17,000 recipients. Top five other states are Washington, California, Arizona, Idaho, and Nevada, with Washington having more than the other four states combined. Other countries, we send retirement payments to 38 other countries, only about 300 recipients, but they're spread across the globe. Total about 5 million in 2006. Top five other countries, Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan. Again, with Canada having more than the other four countries combined. You can kind of see both from where state where the population centers are and where the state employment centers are is where our retirees are primarily located. Marion County is the top county, gets 340 million. Multnomah County, 338, Washington, and Clackamas, also large, and Lane County, all over 200 million. On the east side, I thought it was interesting, Mr. Chair, Umatilla County, $42 million in benefit payments annually into Umatilla County, Deschutes, 94, and even some of our less sparsely populated counties like Malheur, we're injecting $16 million into that county. Maybe to put these numbers are large. Maybe to put them in context, you can think of this as kind of the PERS payroll. Goes out to 117,000 recipients total. about $2.6 billion. The budgets that you cover, the Oregon legislature covering the state employees, it's a state payroll of about, state employees and university employees, about $1.8 billion and goes out to 39,000 people. So, you know, we have about three times the number of recipients and about 50% more than the state payroll that we're handling every year in terms of retirement payments. Obviously quite an impact on the economies in those areas where those monies are being spent. The chart on page six is just our organization chart. You'll see our divisions. You see how the positions are lined out in those divisions and the responsibilities. I would note that in the governor's recommended budget, we've got 403 positions, 301 of them on a permanent basis, 102 limited duration, and only 8 new position requests. And later on, I'll detail where those are. Page 7 lists our strategic plan objectives. We've worked on a strategic plan with our board for the last 3 years, developed this list of 7 key objectives. You'll look at them and you'll say those are pretty plain vanilla objectives, you know, nothing rocket science or brain surgery, but really it's the kind of things that for us to do our business well, we've got to become good in all 7 of these areas. Appendix A in your presentation document shows those strategies in detail as well as key indicators for each of the objectives. But I just go through them. You know, obviously our a key responsibility is produce timely and accurate payments of PERS benefits, deliver high quality customer service, organize the agency in a manner that optimizes its effectiveness and efficiency, have business processes that are efficient and cost effective, ensure that our agency staff has the skill set required to support these strategic outcomes. Key for us, provide a secured information environment. You just heard me go through the amount of payments that we process, 117,000. Remember, every one of those has got a Social Security number associated with it, and it's incumbent on us to provide a secured information environment. Agency communications are clear, concise, and accurate. I might point out that when I get together in our all-staff meetings, I reinforce 3 things continuously. It's 3 things that everyone at PERS owns. They all own data quality, they all own data integrity, and that's data security as well, and they all own customer service. Turning under tab 2, we go into our key issues and challenges driving the budget. Again, this is something that we shared with you during the overview. It's our age demographics. We call it the age wave, the wave that's coming at us in terms of processing retirements. Overall, 28% of our members are eligible to retire. And what we've discovered, of course, is that the closer they get to retirement, the more they demand the services that we provide in terms of our call center, our benefit estimates, our group presentation, our website information. They request assistance in completing the retirement forms. We have to calculate membership eligibility, service time, contribution issues, and if there's any need to reconcile those with employers, we do that work. And then something that we've become increasingly aware of, the post-retirement transactions and service demands are also increasing dramatically with a greater number of living retirees. In the last 5 years, we've had about 35,000 retirements, about 7,000 a year average. That's increased our retiree pool by about 50%. And we touch active members about 6 times a year with annual statements and correspondence. We touch retired members up to 18 times a year with monthly payments, with 1099s, with the correspondence, their address changes, their WP4s. And one of the things that, again, we're becoming increasingly aware of is our work isn't completed when we retire someone. Indeed, to a large degree, it just starts. And that pool is getting bigger and bigger over time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I know that you're trying to strike this fine balance between excellent customer service, and when you say you're touching one of your members 18 times in a year, is that typical? Is it comparable to what the private sector would do managing a retirement account? I remember in this building a few years ago, before your service began at PERS, the question about one-on-one counseling versus group counseling in an attempt to try to find economies.
Mm-hmm.
Is 18 contacts the right amount? Is it excessive? Should there be less?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, for our retirees, obviously, when we're making monthly payments, monthly deposits into their bank accounts or cutting them checks, we've got 12 right there. When someone gets close to retirement, well, our active members on average, we only touch 6 times a year. When they get close to retirement, they're contacting us almost continuously. We are providing application assistance over the phone. May not be the most efficient way to do it, but right now that's what our, and through our group presentations and our website. We're trying to do all three of those. We do provide one-on-one assistance in special cases, divorces, judges, and you know, it's something that we'd like to look at in terms of being able to escalate cases, because there's some of these that are really difficult to resolve just over the phone. Yeah. In terms of the of where those eligible members that are eligible to retire lie, state about 30%. Of the state active and inactive members, so that's about 15,000 people. Local government, about 25% of their workforce is eligible to retire. Schools, about 27%. Judges, small pool, 180 judges, two-thirds of them eligible to retire. And they're one that has a high demand for services. And then community colleges, about 40% eligible to retire. And you'll see, I think, as we get into our POPs, how our four major POPs focus on these challenges right here: our RIMS conversion, policy option package, our retirement processing, our retirement data support, and our infrastructure and operations support. Because this is the key workload that we perform, and that's where our budget focus is as well. Other issues, again, just the workload associated with the new programs. We now administer 4. Everyone has at least 2 accounts that we maintain with 2 annual statements. We also pay out 2 retirement benefits or 2 withdrawal benefits and issue 2 1099-Rs on those. Here, those 3 core POPs, retirement processing, data support, and infrastructure are focused on that issue. The Oregon Supreme Court rulings on the Strunk-Eugene cases requiring us to go back and touch a second time, if you will, 45,000 benefit recipients. We've already recalculated the account balances for over 100,000 active and inactive members, but it's the people who were out the door that we're now having to go back in and recalculate their benefits and recover overpaid benefits. That's the focus of this package. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Dallas. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cleary, if we could go back to the every person now has 2 accounts.
Right.
With 2 annual statements, is that the OPSRP, if a member comes in strictly OPSRP,
strictly OPSRP, we don't have a member account in OPSRP.
So
they've got an IEP.
The
they've got an IEP account, right?
Thank you.
All our Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, which is the majority of our members, are the ones that have got both accounts. Right.
Thank you.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, since we're interrupted here for a second, Paul, earlier you mentioned one-on-one counseling in special cases. Are you looking at, and maybe this will come in later when you're talking about your POPs, but are you looking at going back to a system where there's more one-on-one counseling available for folks as they're looking at their retirements and trying to make some decisions about when, where, you know, all of those sorts of things?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, we're providing it now on the phone. May not be the most efficient way to do it. And so we're looking at how can we supplement that with some other capabilities. And you'll see in our customer service survey, that was one of the things that came out. And we had developed our budget prior to doing our customer service survey, so it wasn't incorporated in our budget. I'm sure it's something that we'll have some discussion on. If we were to look at it again, we'd look at it primarily probably around our group presentation teams. What can we do to keep people over for a day or go early and then have a forms turn-in session where people can come in? And what they want to do is just as they're filling out that form, they just want to make sure that they're interpreting our options, they're interpreting our statutory and regulatory provisions correctly. It's a big decision, and so they'd like to do that. And like I say, right now we do it on the phone. We're not looking at the same piece of paper they are. We're having to look at three different screens to call up their information and so forth. But it's one area where if we want to improve our customer service rating, it's something we've got to look at. How do we fill that hole and fill it in an economical manner? One-on-one counseling is expensive.
Right.
But if you can do it more in conjunction with group presentations, you might be able to do some things more efficiently.
Okay, thank you.
Paul?
Sir?
How much of this is online, can be online?
The forms are online now. We're trying to provide, and when you go on it, you click on a box and it'll pop up and try to explain what those are, what the options are, and so forth. But you can't submit the forms electronically. Retirement systems around the nation are trying to figure out how to do that with the fact that we don't really have the electronic signature capabilities. But you can download them. You can fill them out online. You can download them. We try to provide through our website organized information. We just started with what we call an A to Z help directory, where all you got to do is type in the topic and it'll direct you to the part of the website that'll answer that question. So we do a lot. We do what we can online, and we know that down the road that's going to be the most efficient way to do things. But it's kind of that combination of online phone calls and face-to-face that the systems that seem to be rated high and from a customer service rating, that's where they get their high rating.
And we're behind the power curve on that.
We're behind the power curve on that, yes, sir. But we're hoping to get up on the power curve in a number of different areas. Again, do it the most efficient way possible, though.
Thank you.
The Strunk-Eugene package is one where it's all the positions in that, 57 positions, are limited duration. We've been working with our budget analysts and Dallas on the question of what kind of workforce management plan are you going to have. We've developed one to control the project staffing and related costs because we know that those positions are going to phase down over time. And so you'll see in our 2% efficiencies, I think we've identified about a 10% reduction in that package in recognition of that phase down. Ongoing litigation, we're in 23 different lawsuits pending or on appeal in 65 contested cases. I'd like to think that the lawsuit numbers will diminish over this biennium. Some of the major issues have been resolved by the Oregon Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but there still is litigation going on, a lot of it around the Strunk-Eugene recovery effort. We've got a policy option package that gives us a limitation of $1 million to retain outside counsel that we use for both the reform-related litigation and contested cases, as well as the tax qualification issues for the plan.
Well, excuse me. Of these 65 contested cases or 23 lawsuits that are out there pending, how much of these are a consequence of the, or coming out of the PERS reform package a few years ago?
I would say that the majority of the lawsuits are related to the reform package. The contested cases, some of those are related to the adjustments that we're doing with Strunk Eugene, but we normally have contested cases around disability reviews, around disputes over whether a benefit estimate should be the final payment, even though there may be a correction to account information and so forth. So, but the lawsuits are reform related. Yeah. Another challenge for us, of course, is we've got these two major special projects going on, the RIMS conversion project, our IT conversion project, and the Strunk Eugene project. We have to simultaneously staff those as well as our day-to-day operations. We've only got so many subject matter experts, so we try to keep them deployed where they'll make the most, get the biggest bang for the buck out of them, and we're having to move them around on a pretty regular basis. The RIMS conversion project is primarily to address the fact that we've got an outdated information technology system that was not kept up to date with all the new system changes. That's why we had to start calculating a lot of retirement benefits outside of RIMS using desktop applications. People used to use the manual term. I can assure you we don't have pencil to the to paper, but we do have a lot of desktop-supported applications that we have to pull information out of RIMS, run them through those applications, and then put the information back in. Our conversion project, we're midway through that, and our POP is 111 on that.
Okay. Are we doing this with the state data center, and where are we at with DAS on this topic?
Chair Jensen, of course, the overall project we work with DAS IRMD on from a quality assurance and project oversight standpoint. We report to the JLC IMT on a regular basis. If you're asking about the state data center, a lot of our work is done on DAS's mainframes, and you'll see we've got a pretty hefty charge for that in our overall budget. And those mainframes have been lifted and now are located within the state data center. We're not scheduled to move until the next biennium into that, with the idea that we wanted to complete the RIMS conversion project, have our servers on site while we were doing that. But eventually we are scheduled to move, and the 24/7 coverage that could provide we think could be beneficial to the agency. Then of course, while we're doing the RIMS conversion project, it's not a big bang project. We're not building a parallel track and then going to jump onto it. We're actually bridging both systems. All our data now is coming in through jClarity. Our legacy data resides in RIMS, so we have to use both systems, and we bridge between them. The next several pages, something that required under the co-chair's instructions, but certainly I'll leave it to you as to whether you want me to go into any detail. I would just point out that we've got 7 PERS-sponsored bills that are primarily aimed at simplifying program administration, trying to improve the understandability, and reduce the potential for conflicts. Those are the first 7 that are listed on page 11, 12, and 13. And then on 14 and 15, 16, we go through other legislation that has been introduced this session that impacts PERS. This legislation all addresses some specific concerns. I think the sponsors are interested in either addressing specific concerns or adding more flexibility and options. We haven't identified any major impacts associated with any of these statutes to date. I would point out none of them are aimed at revamping the major portions of PERS reform. So people seem to have accepted that the changes that the legislature made in 2003 have helped ensure that the system's sustainable, and none of those changes are being challenged in this legislation. But unless the committee's interested, I'll just leave it at that for you in terms of our legislation.
see no objection to that. So.
Okay. Might now move to tab 3, and this is our performance measure overview. And I'd point out we don't have any direct ties to the formal Oregon benchmarks, but certainly the services provided by our members have direct ties to those. And so by supporting recruitment and retention of public employees throughout Oregon, we've got indirect ties to areas including the economy, education, civic engagement, and public safety. We look to our statutory and mandated services and missions to ensure our agency performance. We've got numerous sources for assessing our performance, including the high-level key performance measures. We do an annual benchmarking and cost comparison analysis with a third-party entity called CEM Benchmarking, Inc. They compare us to a peer group of somewhere between 20 and 25 different retirement systems. Similarly sized. Difficult comparisons because every retirement system administers different programs. Some retirement systems have integrated investment and plan administration. Ours has the investment being handled by the Oregon Investment Council and State Treasury. We're running three different pension programs plus an individual account program. We're pretty unique in that. At the activity level, some really good comparisons and some good ideas as to how we can become more efficient. We also look at progress on our strategic plan objectives and key indicators.
Can we back up to this? What you mean by this at the activity level? We have some pretty meaningful projections. So, can you be a little more specific on that?
Well, when they'll break down our overall budget into 15 or 20 different activities, a pension inception, cost to produce a benefit estimate, what we do in terms of counseling that, and we've got detailed comparisons there where we're cheaper than others and where we're more expensive than others, and so then we can compare.
Where's this data hidden at?
It's not hidden. It's in a huge report that I think we've got electronically, and we'd be happy to provide. We just got the 07 report. I think I've got a copy right here. This is their report. Just came out February 9th.
I don't think we all want that, that whole report tonight.
I'd be happy to go through and maybe...
Is that available just online?
We can make it available online, yeah.
So that we can go ahead and look at it if we want.
Yeah, right. We'll certainly do that. And maybe what I'll do is I'll go through here tonight and copy a couple of the pages, and we can talk about those tomorrow.
That'd be great.
Okay. At the executive team level, we also use monthly production line reports where we track incoming, completed, and pending status for about 30 different activities and processes that are at our level, just at PERS, and five different reconciliation accounts. And then also we use our monthly budget reports to our board to track progress. We compare our actual versus expected expenditures at the detailed account level, which is, in my experience at least, directing three different agencies, we provide more budget information at PERS to our board than I provided at my other agencies, and they're interested in seeing where we are on a monthly basis. Perhaps some of the corporate background of three of our members indicated there. In terms of our key performance measure history, Appendix B has a detailed report on FY 05-06 performance measures, but we've had a struggle at PERS. We did an audit in 2003-04 that identified that the previous set of KPMs had some significant deficiencies. We replaced them with some interim KPMs for 05-07, and then this year we've improved on those, I believe, by making some data source improvements as well as changing in some of the measures.
excuse me, once again, the 0304 audit, that's an internal audit I see here.
Right, our internal audit shop did that.
Your agency would have had, correct me if I'm wrong, an audit when you came on board.
We've had numerous audits, but we had a change of director audit.
Excuse me, a Secretary of State.
Right.
When you came on board.
Yeah.
Have you had a subsequent Secretary of State audit?
Chair Jensen, we, because of our size, we have an annual audit of our combined financial report, our CAFRA report, and we just got the Secretary of State's audit there, had no reportable conditions and no management letter either. We've also had an IT system application report. There were change of directors reports, but yeah, we're a regular customer of the Secretary of State Audit Division.
You're generous in keeping him employed.
We've worked hard over the last half year with the Progress Board, with LFO and with BAM, on trying to fine-tune these KPMs and get them to where we can actually use them over the long term. So I might just, I'm on page 19 here, run through what our proposed KPMs are for 07-09. Again, primary focus, timely retirement payments, and this is percent of initial service retirement payments paid within 45 days of retirement date. This is the idea that people shouldn't suffer a break in income, if you will. Remember, they got paid the end of the month or whenever at the end of their employment segment if they're moving right from employment into retirement, and we try to shoot to pay them. Our measure here is to shoot to pay them within 45 days of that date. Statutorily, we've got up to 92 days to make that payment. Oregon takes a different tack than a lot of systems. About 80% of the systems make estimated payments so they can get a check out the door right away. They say, we know that, you know, you're going to be within this amount. Maybe we'll give you 80% of what we think. We've attempted to follow the approach of doing the work once and get a final payment benefit out the door. Probably a more difficult task, and one that we may have to re-examine, as you can see. You know, the numbers recently since reform and Strunk Eugene have certainly diminished. If you look at the data there, 2000, we got almost 80% of them out the door in 45 days. We only were processing about 3,300 retirements then. Retirements jumped up to about 5,000 in 2001, 7,000 in 2002. At the same time, our completion data went down. PERS reform kicked in 2003, and with that, we had both a retirement spike, about 12,500 retirements, as well as new obligations. We had to do a look-back calculation. We had to incorporate new actuarial factors, and that's where you see the dramatic decline there. 2004, we're now bridging two different systems. We're having to process separations through Clarity and all the legacy data is in RIMS. 2005, we got the Strunk Eugene decisions, and we're doing the account recrediting. And then 2006 is when we move full forward in the Strunk Eugene resource draw. Again, when I look at this, you know, I wonder whether we're following the right model of trying to get a final benefit out. My staff tells me they'd love to just touch these things once, and ideally that's what you do. And, you know, you try to paint the entire house. But if we continue not to be able to make better progress on this KPM, we may have to look at going to an estimated payment, because it's not fair to people to have them wait that long for their benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, after 03, you kind of quit telling us the number of retirees, and I was sort of trying to. Can you tell us the number of retirees that were impacted there?
After in 04, we had about 6,000. 05, about 4,500. 06, about 5,500. And then you might recall 05 and 06, those are just the pension retirements. After those dates, we also, about half of those had an IEP retirement with them as well. So that, so you might say we were doing around 9,000 transactions for those two dates. So obviously, number of retirees affects this, as well as the kind of work that you got to do associated with it. But again, it's something that I think strategically we've got to look at whether the model we're, the business model we're following is the business model we want to adhere to.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow up. As Paul, as the J Clarity gets more online and RIMS is being phased out, do you see that? Do you see these numbers as improving because of the efficiencies that, that are built into J Clarity and the fact that you're not going to have to be running down parallel tracks?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, yes, we do. We see that as a major contributor from the J Clarity project, as well as the work we're doing at the front end on the data. A lot of the problems that you have at retirement is reconciling data anomalies. And if we're cleaning those up at the front end, for someone to retire, we should be able to process that a lot quicker. Employers have up to 30 days to report a separation, and that's another area we've got to work with. Because obviously if they don't report it for 30 days, then we're basically giving ourselves 15 days to process that retirement, and that's near impossible. So, you know, it's something that we're talking with employers. How can we improve that to get that information in quicker?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Galizio.
I'm just curious if with these numbers, these, you know, this large percentage of people not paid within 45 days, do you, can you give us an idea of how long they waited during some of these years?
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizio, all of them we pay within that 92-day statutory requirement. So the average was probably creeping up to 60 days or so. But, you know, if we can't get it done on a final basis, we send an estimated payment out in that 92-day period. You know, you hate to tell people, you got to save enough money to survive 3 months of no income. So, you know, there again, you know, our business model maybe is as much at fault as anything.
Did I understand correctly, Paul, that you're never delinquent, i.e. the 92 days, statutorial days?
Chair Jensen, when you're processing the number of retirements that we're processing, I never say never. We could have had, you know, a handful. But if they are, they're top priority.
A de minimis.
Yeah, a de minimis amount.
That's what I would have meant. By
right.
Never. Thank you.
Turning to page 20, here we're trying to measure our total administration cost per member. And with the idea that as we become more efficient, we can handle the increase in workload per member as well as any cost inflation and not see increasing cost per member. Right now we're at about $10 per month per member to administer the three pension programs, the IEP, OSGP, and retiree health insurance. This is our entire program here. The reason why we're, you see the asterisks on those targets for 06 and 09, or 06 and 07, those targets didn't cover our entire program. And so we thought that it made a lot more sense for people to relate our full budget to our cost per member. We didn't want to exclude special project costs. We didn't want to exclude OSGP and retiree health benefits. So you can kind of see we peaked in 2005 at 139. We've fallen down to 120. We'd like to not go above 120 and actually see that decrease. And there again, you know, the work we're doing on the technology enhancements and process improvements, we believe are going to help us stabilize those costs per member. Same thing on KPM.
It's really annoying when someone goes backwards, but I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just on the, you said employers have 30 days to report the retirement of employees.
Employers have up to 30 days to report a separation.
To report a separation.
So, you know, if my last day at work was the end of the month, they've got until the end of the next month to actually report it to us.
Do you think that time could be shortened?
That's one of the things that we think strategically.
Are they walking
yeah.
it over?
Some of it is, you know, we've got employees or members that work for multiple employers. Substitute teachers may be working for three or four different districts, and they're working for one, and that district knows they've retired, but because they were last working there. But some of the districts that they worked for earlier in the fall or so aren't aware that they've submitted their separation papers. So it's that communication between the member and the employer, and communication with PERS that I think we can improve in order to close that gap there.
One other question before we leave this. The target, the $120, what's the industry range on this?
Industry standard for total cost?
Administrative cost.
I've got that figure. I'm thinking it was around 109.
Why don't we use the industry standard?
Well, again, adjusted for our programs, we're not the same as the rest of the industries, but certainly, you know, if the committee prefers, we can set that in as a target.
I'm not, I just was asking a question. I wasn't making an initial proposal here. Okay.
I think what we'd like to do, of course, is say, okay, we've got increasing workload per member, and we know that costs go up over time. What we'd like to do is see that cost per member not go above that and actually start declining over time. And, you know, all we're showing is 2 years' worth of targets, so hopefully in future biennials we would be working down towards, you know, a lower level.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Paul, this KP2 is a benefit administration cost. This is annual for just the cost of administrating the benefit.
Chair Jensen, Senator Wisnant, it's our total cost for administering the program.
Okay.
So it's all of our costs. It's our total budget, right? Not just the benefit side. And then on KPM3, this again is total staff per membership. You know, you can see where we certainly have increased our staff over 04 and 05 compared to the pre-reform eras. I think what you're seeing here is obviously the workload per member has basically doubled with reform and the Strunke gene adjustments. So I think if you weighted this for the workload, you've actually seen some productivity improvements when you're just using these raw measures. You don't pick that up. Here again, our goal is to maintain or see that level decline. The technology enhancements and process improvements that we're implementing, we believe, are going to help us achieve that. Page 22 is our focus on our deferred compensation program, KPM4, average dollars deferred. This is the average monthly deferral per state employee deferred compensation participant. We're just focusing on state employees here because that's what our historical data has covered. The local governments now can enroll in this program, and we've got about 140 of them or so that are in it, but their members also have a number of other alternative supplemental retirement savings programs. So we use state employees only. And I think you're going to see that this program we're going to put increasing emphasis on because it's going to be critical to successful retirements, particularly with the rising health care costs. We compare well to your standard 401k with this program, particularly when you consider that a lot of the 401ks are the primary source of retirement income rather than the supplemental source of retirement income. We've got pretty good participation. Our goal, you'll see in KPM 5, our goal is to get up into the close to the 40% range. I think 401ks, because they're the primary, have about 60% participation or so, but for a supplemental savings program, that's pretty good participation. Again, one that I think people are starting to become aware with those rising health care costs that they've got to have something else to bridge the gap between retirement and Medicare, and this is a key way to help bridge that gap. KPM 6, customer service survey. I was a little nervous when the requirement came out to survey customers because we had just launched our Strunk Eugene project where we were reducing benefits for about a third of our retirees. You know, but actually, I'll tell you, it was a great requirement. I'm really appreciative of the legislature telling agencies to do this, because if you're not going out talking to your customers, you might be implementing things that they don't value, and you're missing things that they really do value. We're not where we want to be here. You can see it, and you'll particularly see it on the employer rating. It's a focus of our POPs. We're doing customer service training for the entire agency. We've just organized a retiree focus group. We wanted people who've just been through the process to come in and help us redesign the process. And then we're developing service level agreements between the divisions that when this separation gets submitted by an employer, it gets processed within X days in order to get it over to the benefit payment people. Because even though we asked it at probably one of the worst times, we're not happy with these ratings. We want 80% of them to rate good or excellent. We didn't get a lot of poor ratings. We had a lot of fair. And, you know, for some people, that's just the way they rate anything. We want to push more of that into the good and excellent rating area. KPM 7 is timely benefit estimates, percent of benefit estimates processed within 30 days of eligible request. An eligible request is, are you within 2 years of retirement? If you're within 2 years of retirement, you can request a written estimate. If you get two a year free, anything over two, you have to pay $60 for. And people ask for different estimates based on different retirement dates. They say, well, if I go out in July, you know, this is what I'm going to get. If I wait until January, this is what I get. So they'll ask for multiple estimates. Generally, they're satisfied with the two. We haven't seen a lot of people demanding additional ones at their expense. Our goal is to process 95% of those within 30 days. We processed about 10,250 written benefit estimates in 2006, give you an idea of the volume, and we did pretty well. We've also got a benefit estimate calculator on our website. Now, that doesn't have the same level of precision that the calculator that we use in the written estimates. One of the things we're doing with the RIMS conversion project is we're going to have the same calculator on the website as we use in-house. So if people input the same data, they'll get the identical estimate. And we think that that'll help meet this demand as well. We're excited about that. And it's part of our member self-service package it's coming online more near the end of the biennium, but we believe that that's going to really help in terms of meeting this demand. Pretty high goal here, but we think it's one we can achieve. We have seen a real spike in retirement estimates requests this beginning of this year. Looks like July may be a heavy year or heavy month for retirements. I think people have kind of waited on the sidelines to see how the reform shook out and what happened with the court decisions and all that. So some of those, that 30% or so that are eligible to retire, look like they're heading towards the door here. So this will probably be a year where we'll see a pretty high number of retirements. KPM 8, here's the one where I'm probably most disappointed, our employer satisfaction numbers. You know, we basically put our employers through the ringer over the last 3 years. We implemented a new electronic data exchange reporting system. Not the simplest thing to do. Talking with other systems, they took 18 months to prep their employers on it. We took 4. We kind of threw them to the wolves then. We've got, like I say, over 870 to 880 employers. They're submitting 12,000 reports a year and about 2.7 million records on a system that we're continuing to try to make more user-friendly, but when it first got implemented, it felt like a black box to them. So what are some things that we're doing to respond to these service ratings? We've reinstated our regional employer outreach program. We've gone to a caseworker assignment within our member employer relations section, where each employee has got a certain region and certain number of employers. The employers want to deal with the same person, and we had been just kind of rouletting them, and we've instituted that caseworker approach. They're appreciative of that, and then we've developed a new major IT release that's going to come out in May that we think is going to really help them, particularly in terms of making corrections and prior period adjustments. And this is a system, because of the coverage of part-time employees, particularly school districts are having a struggle with this, because of the coverage of part-time employees, substitute teachers, there's always the need to be able to go back in and make corrections and prior period adjustments. So we're hopeful that will address a lot of these concerns. We're not happy with these ratings. With employers, we're doing additional survey, and we just completed another survey to get into more specifics. And you'll see it's, again, a focus of a number of our POPs. But the employers, in order for this system to work, it's got to work for the employers. And so they're a key part of our effort here. The final KPM is...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, how much, I know this is going to sound probably kind of silly, but how much are the rates impacting the opinions of the employers from the standpoint? I mean, I understand the technology aspects, and I understand the reports and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, but how much, you know, when an employer looks at that and says, holy cow, you know, I've now got 24% of my payroll is going towards retirement benefits and the board doesn't get it and, you know, whatever else they might be saying, but how much of an impact is it?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, again, timing not being the best for this particular survey. The rates didn't go anywhere near what they were projected to go pre-reform, but they did climb some. And, you know, our average rate system-wide for the next biennium is somewhere around 15%. The employers would like to see that back in the historical range of around 11% or so. And we think we're going to get there. But when we did this survey, they were just starting to hear, you know, about the rates for the next year. We were implementing late reporting penalties on employers, and we had a huge workload associated with lump sum payments that we originally declared were not covered salary, and then the legislature clarified for us last session that they were covered salary, so a lot of rework there. The board decided in that case that they would use the contingency reserve to credit the employers for the contributions and earnings that were associated with those, because it's about $4 million or so total, because it wasn't the employer's fault. We had instructed them not to report them. And so for 2 years, we weren't collecting money on those lump sum payouts. So again, not the best timing. And these surveys, you know, we got 360 employers, I think, that responded on this. So you don't know whether the ones that don't respond are satisfied, and what you're getting is a bias for people who aren't necessarily happy. You know, I've learned throughout my career, you know, you make a customer happy, they tell two people. You make them unhappy, they tell 200, and I think they probably also fill out a survey. So, you know, there may be some bias there. I think the requirement for this was really useful, and I don't know what you're hearing from other agencies, but I know I was nervous about this. I had no idea that the employers were this upset with us. So it was great that we went out and did this, and we're following up in a number of areas. KPM 9, this is a new requirement of all agencies that have governing boards. And so we've got a requirement that we measure ourselves against this best practices list. You know, our board is engaged in the budget. They're engaged in our strategic planning, our administrative rulemaking, legislation, legal actions, contested cases, major projects, audit committee, and director performance evaluation. So I don't think we're going to have any trouble matching up really well with those best practices, and we'll be preparing that for the next biennium. We are deleting one KPM, and this is the total benefit administrative costs, excluding special projects. Again, it was kind of redundant with KPM 2, what is now KPM 2, and is really subjective in terms of what were special project costs. We've got a requirement now to go back and make a number of adjustments for what's called the Young case, involving overtime retirements for certain state employees back in 96, I think, was when this decision was made, or when the payments were made. Is that a special project, or is that just, you know, the cost of doing business? So we thought that this KPM could be deleted. Again, we use them in management and budget development. We've got these results, I think, that will help us gauge the progress we're making. Certainly will help us measure the impact that our RIMS conversion project will have, as well as the impact that some of the other business process improvements we're putting in place will have. You know, it's been an interesting 3 years for me. We now have these major court rulings, and we just got one from the Ninth Circuit in December that upheld the PERS reform from the federal court challenge. But we now know what programs we're administering, and we can now focus on the operational improvements around those programs. Continuous process improvements. Appendix D.
Senator Vincent.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I wonder if it would be possible for the customer service. Obviously, is satisfaction is not good. It's a third of the employees don't like it, and over half of the employers don't. I wonder if we could get, with the chair's permission, if we could get some information on what questions we're asking and what the response to those questions were. So if there's a weighted area where they're more dissatisfied than not.
Do we have any information?
Chair Jensen, Senator Witz, yeah, we certainly can. These are the six questions that all agencies were required to ask, and it's in, you know, rating on overall service, timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, but I can get you the actual survey instrument so you can see what we asked there. And then for the employers, we've got additional surveys that we're doing, and I'll share that with you as well.
Thank you.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Powell.
Thank you. I'm going to back up for a second, Paul. Your proposed deletion of KPM number 2, and one of the reasons that you gave there is that it's redundant with the other cost per member KPM. Which other cost per member KPM is that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, it's the new KPM 2, where we're looking at total benefit administration costs, which includes special projects and so forth. We used to have two, one that was administration cost, and then another that excluded the special projects. And and we're saying, you know, if people go to our budget, they're going to wonder where we're hiding dollars, because they're not going to be able to come up with the total cost there.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. So the one that you presented with us on page 20 is the new one.
Right.
And the this old number two right. is what you're...
Right, okay. Right.
Thank you.
Sorry for that confusion. Again, now turning to page 30, this is just kind of a summary listing. The full listing of continuous process improvements is in Appendix D. And we've kind of organized these in three different areas. What are we doing to improve our accountability and our customer service? What are we doing to handle increasing workload? And then what have we got both ongoing and planned from a process improvement standpoint? Again, I can't give enough credit to the PERS board for the work that they've done in terms of improving the transparency and accountability of the program, implementing conservative earnings crediting, reserving practices, using fair market value actuarial methods, and reduced amortization periods. There's new accounting requirements coming out for public plans, and we're ahead of the curve in all of those areas. We know where we are and where we're going in terms of what the board has done. We spent a lot of time on financial modeling, and the numbers that we share with you reflect, again, fair market value methods. One of the things that we just implemented beginning of this year was imaging of our incoming documents. We used to just image those documents at the end of the process for archival purposes, but now we're imaging the incoming documents to allow staff to easily locate them and develop these workflow processes. Our call center people have commented to me several times about what an improvement this has been. When somebody calls in now and says, "Did you receive my application?" We're not looking on 400 desks. We can say, "Yeah, your application came in. It was imaged as of this date." We changed some of our staff assignments. We're doing a lot of the imaging at night. There was a concern that it might delay the processing of the documents. We're turning them out in one day, so there's no additional delay there. And again, a use of a technology that previously wasn't available, but we think it's going to be a real improvement. The customer satisfaction surveys, again, you know, we have to do a better job meeting those customer needs, and those surveys, I think, are going to help us target those efforts. We put our call center people on full time. We used to have they worked phones half a day, and they went and did other work a half a day. And there was such a transition period there that we weren't getting the coverage that we wanted. So they're on the phones full time. Takes a special person. You're handling 100, 150 phone calls a day. We get 700 or 900 calls a day. But we've reduced our call abandonment rate again when people hang up because they feel like they've been waiting and too long, and we've also increased that first call resolution. And then I think an improvement that our fiscal service division people did in response to concerns that we'd had from retirees, we replaced the Social Security number on all our electronic and hard copy retiree payments, as well as our financial institution transmissions. Even though this was just between us and another financial institution that the member had their money deposited in, they were concerned about the fact that there were Social Security numbers on those transactions. And, you know, we think that this is a major improvement in terms of ID security for those retirees. In terms of handling increasing workload, you've heard about our strategic planning and our two-year tactical planning. Another thing that the new board has brought: when we do major projects, we prepare a detailed business plan for them, and we do compass checks on that business plan with the board on a regular basis. So We brought a new discipline to major project management. You know, this is both a good and bad one, implementing that electronic reporting data system. Obviously, it allows more timely data to be transferred, a significant effort on both our part and employer's part, one that we're continuing to search for improvements in. The web-based member and employer presentations, Mr. Chair, you'd asked about these. You know, we got about 900,000 website visits last biennium or last year in 2006. And obviously, anything we can do to help people via the website is the cheapest help that we can provide. So it's an area that we continue to look for improvements in. We are going to be migrating here, I believe, within the next couple of months to the new state web template, which is a vast improvement over what we originally had, to the point where people that actually study web use, you know, have determined that most people are right-handed and right eyesight focus, and they're looking for information on the right-hand side of the page rather than on the left-hand side of the page. And the original state page had everything over on the left-hand side, and you'll see now that the vast majority's moved over to the right-hand. The IAP, we've made a major effort in terms of remediating the individual account program. We had to make that work for members and employers because it's going to be a key retirement component in future years. We've moved to annual earnings for that. People understand it. Allows us to do prior period adjustments. You know, we think that at least this year when people get their annual statements and see a 15.02% return, they should be happy. Maybe we'll do a customer satisfaction survey around that one. We implemented the application programming changes. This is an interesting one. When we had to do Strunk Eugene, we had to figure out to do things in RIMS that it was designed to prevent. We had to, RIMS was designed to prevent reopening of accounts that were in a payout status. I mean, that's, you know, from a security standpoint, that's the last thing you want, is somebody to be able to go into an account that's already been paid out or is in a payout status and adjust data. It's kind of like going in, figuring out a way to tunnel into Fort Knox and pull out the 4,500 gold bars that you got to grab and shave them off and stick them back in and not leave any trace of how you got in or allow anything else to happen while you're there. And that's what we had to do with this Strunk Eugene project. And I think it, because it's the book of record for all those transactions, we wanted to use it as the recalculation as well. So that was a major improvement and something that I think is going to help us in terms of the jClarity conversion data migration as well. Ongoing and planned process improvements. We've got the RCP completion, that's a RIMS conversion project, scheduled for November of 2009. And we believe that's going to automate a number of our calculation processes, eliminate some of those desktop, give us much better audit and quality control account reconciliation tools. From a people standpoint, we have what's called retirement counselors. We know we're not counseling on retirement. We're looking at a new classification for those folks, a retirement specialist class that we think will provide better ability to develop staff and retain staff. The retirement counselor series has only got two steps in that series, and one of the problems we have, like in our call center, people can't move up. So some of our most experienced people, some of the people we want to retain in the call center because they do such a good job of customer service, after their 6 years or so, they're not able to, there's no career path there. And so in this retirement specialist class, we're hoping that DAS will allow us to create some career paths. And that's a class study, not a reclassification study that's going on. Technology-wise, member self-service capabilities, key for us. We obviously have got to be able to provide the ability for retirees to do things like change their W4P, their withholding statements, notify us of their change of address. These folks are moving around all the time, and We think that by providing member self-service over the web, it'll certainly make us more efficient and cut down on the hard copy methods we're currently using. We're going to a case management model with our disability team. There again, a special population, one that deserves to have contact with the same people that they've been dealing with over time, and this model, as opposed to the you get who you get when you make the call, we think will be a real improvement in service. And then we're, from a form standpoint, we're redesigning that service retirement application. You know, we don't want people to be confused. We don't want them to think that PERS has got to be their second language. So we've got to get this stuff to where we can explain and get them to fill these forms out as accurately as possible, possibly with some assistance from us as well. I might just point out the next section. I think I've gotten to kind of the point where I wanted to today. This is our program priority summary. We've got just six programs listed here. And for us, we kind of, you know, we administer this single integrated system of retirement, disability, and death benefits. So when we do our 10% reduction, there's nothing in there that we can, we can't cut one of those programs. So for us, it's very much a thin the spokes on the wagon wheel. So you'll see our 10% reductions as if we had eight people doing disabilities. We figure out how do we do it with six people. We can't eliminate the program, but we go in and we thin things out. And our 10% reduction list is, I think, the last appendix. Appendix E has the detail on these priorities. The health, you know, the
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I wonder if you could kind of go back a little bit. It seems like kind of a natural point here, but a number of the bills that that you tabulated here that are going to be brought forward would allow more people to that are retired to go back to work. What effect, if any, will that have on PERS and your staffing and your book work?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitson, we look at each one of those bills to try to prepare a fiscal impact. And we haven't, at this level right now, we haven't identified any significant impacts with any of those. They're again, pretty minor. I'm not sure. I've heard that we might have maybe 200, 300 people statewide that retired and rehired under one of these special exceptions that are in the statutes now, and a lot of them are for services in counties with small populations. The nurses one may be a little bit bigger expansion. From our actuarial standpoint, we don't believe at this level it'll have significant impacts on the program. From an administrative standpoint, obviously, the more exceptions you provide, the more things we have to track. But again, at these numbers, we don't think it's significant. It's a big issue. It's an issue nationwide, and it's one that you know, from a workforce management standpoint, we're having to look at. When you look at that age wave, we got to figure out how is it that we can retain the people that we need. And yet still, you know, manage the succession as well.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
How is, excuse me, how is the OPE handled on these people that have retired and go back to work in general? I mean, is there a kind of a formula for that? How does it work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, I might ask Bill on that. Do you have any idea, Bill, how
they get retired?
Well, there's no if they're fully retired, and they're not falling under one of those exceptions. Well, you know, the 1039 exception, they don't pay into the retirement system anymore. And I don't know how some of the school districts may handle health insurance, or the state may handle health insurance. I believe they come back as temporary employees primarily, without any benefits.
Okay.
but I may be, you know, that may be a question more for human resources. Maybe we can find out about that tonight.
I'd like to know.
Yeah, okay. We can tell you at least how the state deals with it. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. So, Paul, I'm a little bit perplexed in trying to figure this out. Why does a person, you know, fully retire, and I don't know if this is anything that PERS has actually ever studied or not, but why does a person fully retire and then go back to work? Is it because they need extra money? They find out they're not very good at retirement? You know, what are the...
I think it's probably a combination of factors. The retiree health insurance, we don't provide much as a system, and people discover that maybe they go back to work half-time just to get some health insurance coverage or pay for their health insurance. Obviously, there's some tax issues associated with it because your retirement benefit is taxable income. Mm-hmm. And your work salary is taxable income as well, so you'd want to be careful about how much you're giving to government in terms of additional employment. But there's a number of different reasons. Again, we've got a number of exceptions. We don't see that many people going back working full-time. I think we saw a lot of demand for this when PERS reform had kind of these trigger events, and if you retired by this date, you went out under the old formula. If you retired after that date, so we might have had people retire earlier than they expected. And I know from an agency standpoint, it made it really difficult for those of us who had succession plans that, you know, we thought that this person was going to stay there for another 4 years, and they retired to get out the door, and so we tried to keep them around on a 1039 basis, half-time basis, or things like that. I'm sure it's primarily individual decisions. And then I think within the legislature, these exceptions have been created because of the problems that you've had in certain areas of the geographical areas of the state and in certain occupations recruiting qualified people. Okay. You needed to have that pool expanded and the retirees a part of it. I know it's a concern, though, for citizens. You know, the double dipping issue is an issue. If this is going to be expanded, something that's going to have to be addressed.
I agree. Thank you.
I'll go into that here.
Again, it's, you know, this is a program we administer, we don't necessarily create, but we want to make sure that when the legislature is contemplating these changes, we give them the best information possible.
Sure.
So it can be informed decisions.
I guess we do want to go into this here as I think about it a little bit more. As one of those people who has retired into a high-paying job that pays about the same as welfare, maybe not quite as good, but be that as it may, I have never quite been able to understand why we have so much heartburn about somebody retiring from a state position going back into another public sector job, whether that's a state or, you know, whatever it comes from, where we as a state have no problem in hiring somebody who has retired after 30 years from the military, with no problem in hiring somebody who has retired after 30 years from California or Washington. But we only have problem with it when it happens to be one of our own. And it has nothing to do with this budget committee, but you can't get on this topic without producing those comments from me. And I don't know whether we could legally not hire somebody from Washington if they were qualified and applied. I think we might have some legal complications there, one form or another. But we seem to feel like we can do it with our own citizens. Enough said. We will move on. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, again, you know, in terms of our program priorities, our key program, the death, disability, retirement benefit program, number two, our retiree health insurance program, number three, our deferred comp. Social Security coverage program, very small program. We're required to maintain a single point of contact for the federal program, and this is when a public employer wishes to voluntarily join Social Security. We do have some public employers that are not part of Social Security. They generally also aren't part of PERS, and they're running their own benefit program, and a lot of it with local police and fire. A lot of times we'll see some work in this area. We only staff it with one person. And then we have our debt service, our two certificates of participation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've kind of gotten to the point where I thought would be a good point to break. I'm two-thirds of the way through, so I can cover the rest in a half an hour tomorrow, and then you'll have time for testimony.
Thank you, Paul. And I guess I am glad that it took that, because that by taking that minute, it took me to put it right on the money as far as closing time. No questions that can't be held over till tomorrow. We will...